Ink and Paint wishes to acknowledge the Wurundjeri people, the traditional owners of the land on which this podcast is recorded and edited. It is a great privilege to be able to tell stories on this land, which has a tradition of storytelling stretching back over 10,000 years. We also wish to acknowledge the traditional owners of the lands from all over the world where our guests record from. We pay our respects to all elders past, present, and emerging, and to our First Nations listeners.
Now, making an animated film is a cooperative effort. Each artist must be prepared to modify his own pet ideas in order to achieve the best possible solution to the problem. No one has things entirely his own way. But in the end, the result is better than any one of us could have achieved alone.
Hello and welcome to another episode of Ink and Paint, a podcast journey through the Disney animated classics. I'm your host, Daniel Lamont. We're exploring one by one the films in the official Disney animated canon and talking about their artistic, historical, and social context, where they come from, their impact, and how they sit with us now. In our last episode, we looked at the charming canine romance Lady and the Tramp and Walt Disney Animation's transition to widescreen. In this episode, we begin our two-part look at one of the giants of the Disney canon, the mythical and gargantuan Sleeping Beauty. Each episode on Ink and Paint, I'm joined by a special guest, not just film and animation enthusiasts, but people from all different professions. This week, I'm joined by ballet dancer and principal artist for the Australian Ballet, Dimity Azzouri. Dimity began dancing at the age of 4 in her hometown of Queanbeyan, New South Wales. She studied for 11 years at the Kim Harvey School of Dance in Canberra before moving to the Australian Ballet School in 2005. She was accepted into the Australian Ballet in 2008, where she has had the opportunity to travel to Paris, London, New York, Japan, San Francisco, and Los Angeles, and work with such great choreographers as Graham Murphy, Tim Harbour, Stephen Page, Christopher Wheeldon, and Wayne McGregor. Dimity was promoted to soloist in 2015 following her debut as Baroness von Rothbart in Graham Murphy's Swan Lake, to senior artist in 2017, and to principal artist in 2019. Dimity, welcome to Ink and Paint.
Thanks very much for having me.
Let's start from the very beginning. Ballet, how did you come to it at the age of 4? And what was it about it that kept you going with it?
I believe it was my mum who signed me and my neighbourhood friends up to a local ballet school. And I absolutely just fell in love with it. My friends dropped off pretty soon after we started, but I very soon couldn't walk anymore without sort of adding in a little step or two that I just learned.
Was ballet a part of your, you know, ballet or classical music part of your family before you started ballet? Was it something that you went to go and see, that, or that something that your parents were interested in?
I don't particularly remember before the age of 4, but my grandma was a dancer in New Zealand, never professionally. She wasn't really allowed to take that on professionally, but she danced right up until the moment that she married my grandfather. And I do remember every time I went to visit her in Sydney, she'd sit me down and we'd watch one of the Australian Ballet VHSs together.
And what was it about it, if you can remember, at that age that was that drew you to it, that like kind of kept you going with it? What was the quality of ballet that, you know, grabbed your imagination at a young age?
I do remember seeing my first performance. I don't know who it was. It could have even just been a local ballet school. But it was these girls in these long, white, romantic tulle dresses, and I just remember them floating across the stage. It was my one memory, my first memory of seeing ballet on a stage. But I literally just dancing and moving, and it's so challenging. Ballet is extremely hard, and from a young age you have to work to coordinate your body and learn the steps and to achieve these new things, and I found that challenge really addictive from the first.
At what point did you realise that this was going to be something that you were going to commit your life to, that you were going to do as a career? You know, what age were you, and how did you go about making that decision? Because that's a big decision to make.
It is big. It's I think bigger for your parents to allow you to make that decision. I think as a teenager, you don't really have any idea of what you're getting into, which is both a good and a bad. Don't want to overthink these things. but I started auditioning for the Australian Ballet School, which is the leading professional ballet school in Australia. And I was actually rejected 3 times before I eventually got in. So from a young age, it was a dream, but I never really thought that it could be a reality because I just wasn't that successful at it, really.
And what was it like to get accepted? Like, what was it like to be accepted into the school and then to walk into the school? Because it's a prestigious institution. It's a prestigious building. The building itself is impressive.
Oh, it's such a great building. I actually always recognized the smell of it. And so every time I would walk in, for the first time after holidays or that very first time, it had this smell about it. And I think it's probably the ballet floor, the tarkette that we use. It was always very special. But I was just in complete disbelief the whole time. I was so nervous for 4 years of my life. Never thought I'd get a job, never thought that I'd get promoted, that I'd be here 13 years later professionally dancing. I'm still in disbelief, actually.
And what are some of the demands and expectations that are placed on a dancer in professional ballet? What are some of the things that you have to navigate to make it a profession, both in terms of your physicality and your health, but also just daily living and, being able to, have a job and a life and all those kind of things?
It's really tough to sort of balance normal life and ballet, but you get better at it. And I think generally consider ballet as a professional dance as a real lifestyle choice. You can't sort of go to work at the hour that you're meant to go to work and come home and just forget about it. There's so much preparation, as you say, the lifestyle, what you eat, how you keep your body conditioned is all part of it. So it is very much a lifestyle. However, it is also very important to be able to switch off and have a normal life and, even just to add experience to take with you on stage. If you do nothing but eat, sleep and dance, there's not a whole lot of substance to then perform with. So it is important to experience absolutely everything you can.
Totally. I mean, as an artist, you can't imbue your experiences of the world into the work that you make unless you've got experiences of the world to imbue into the work that you make. And being a principal artist at the Australian Ballet, what does that involve? For our listeners, talk about what is the role of a principal artist within a company like that?
Don't actually have a lot of experience yet. As I got promoted, I did 6 shows as principal and then we went into isolation for COVID. But no, I do know what it takes to be a principal. Basically what we do is we perform the lead roles. So, the Auroras, the Odettes, the Juliettes, the Manons, all of those roles. You're not on every night anymore. You just have your shows that you do. And it's a lot of responsibility. You have to carry the whole ballet. It comes with a lot of responsibility, but it comes with the most amazing opportunities as well.
So does that mean within a season of a particular work, there'll be multiple principal artists taking on a single role on alternating nights? Is that the way that it works?
Yeah, it does. So we'll generally, for example, in Sydney, we'll do about 23, 24 shows of a season, and there'll be about potentially five casts of the lead role. That differs, but the harder the ballet, the more role, the more performers you need, because it's physically impossible to do more than, a couple of shows a week.
And how do you navigate finding your own particular texture and flavour for the character you're playing within the choreography? Because I imagine obviously all of the principals over a course of a season are all doing the same choreography. How do you, as an artist, make that choreography your own? What's some of the room that you have in order to be able to put yourself into it?
Well, it's really interesting because you'd go to the ballet every night and, as you say, you are doing the exact same choreography as the person who'd done it the previous night, but every single time you will see a different show, a different interpretation. And there's just the, you know, the ways that you can nuance the actual dancing of the choreography. So slightly you might accent different things, or, you know, as a principal, because you don't necessarily have to dance with 50 other people at the one time, you can play with the music, you can play with how you dance something. But everyone's characters are always so unique. You know, for example, Giselle, who she's a, you know, sweet young peasant girl, goes mad and dies.
typical ballet opera story narrative.
Fantastic, isn't it? Give me a mad scene or a death scene any day. But, you know, there's a thousand different ways you can play her, and it's subtle things, but they do make a very big difference.
Has there been a particular role that you've loved the most that you've been able to dance?
Ooh, I would say Giselle is one of my favourites. Loved Hannah from The Merry Widow. That was great. A lot lighter, just, you know, just a romantic, beautiful story. Oh, I could probably just reel off every single role. Clara in The Nutcracker, in the Graham Murphy version, she didn't have a death scene herself, but her lover died, so that was pretty dramatic. Loved that. I could go on.
I mean, when you're down, you know, you have some of the great narratives in, you know, Western literature and some of the greatest music ever written. I imagine, you know, it's kind of hard to choose between which one might be your favorite.
Yeah.
And why do you think ballet is an art form that people are so drawn to? Like, why is it one that has persisted for so long and continues to kind of capture people's imaginations and draw them into the, well, when they can go to the theaters, draw them into the theaters to see them?
It's just beautiful. And there's really no other word for it. I mean, there's actually lots of other words for it, but it's very simple. It's quite mesmerizing, and there is a magic to it, no matter whether you're in a fairy tale or a non-narrative ballet even. It's a very powerful art form. But I also think a lot of people, especially young girls, have danced and have, so they have that sort of connection to it from a young age. But I've been thinking about this a bit lately, because I was asked recently sort of how relevant ballet is going forward. And I think ballet's power is its ability to tell a story and to, you know, connect with an audience. And so as long as that story is telling something relevant, then ballet has as much, you know, ability to share that than any art form.
There's something so primal and arresting about seeing a narrative told through human bodies in space, and not human, like to be able to look at a human being on a stage engaging in the most beautiful and technically breathtaking physical acts in order to tell a story with only their body to be able to communicate and their communion with the music. There's something just so breathtaking about being in a room with a dancer engaged in that kind of enterprise.
Yeah, nailed it. As in my experience, yes.
Because, I mean, like, one of my favorite piece of classical music is The Rite of Spring, and I listened to it performed by orchestras and before, like, on CD and this kind of thing, and the first time I ever saw it danced to, it wasn't the original choreography, it was a modern version of it. But being in the room, and I remember having this realization of there had always been an instrument missing from the music, which was the human breath and the sound of feet hitting the floor. And it was just like this piece of music that I knew back to front just had this extra power to it because there was human endeavor engaged in it on top of the music itself.
Wow, yeah. We did a collaboration with Bangarra Dance Theatre, which is, I'm not sure if you know, but they're the Indigenous dance company, an amazing one. And, yeah, we did a collaboration called Rites to Rite of Spring. Not only did they have that, but you had that, you know, amazing intensity of the, like, Indigenous dancers as combined with the Australian ballet dancers, and it was something else. It was amazing.
Right. Well, I'm definitely going to be going and looking up clips of that if there are any of them on the internet after this. To continue on with the subject of, you know, the magic of storytelling in an art form, to move on to talking about Disney, do you remember what the very first Disney animated film was that you saw?
Oh, wow. No, I don't remember at all. I remember The Lion King was a big deal to me. We travelled around America for 6 weeks when I was six, listening to the soundtrack nonstop. Sorry, Dad. Aladdin, that was pretty fantastic. Yeah, I don't remember the first one though.
Was Disney a big part of your childhood and your childhood home growing up? Was it something that was it something that your parents let you watch? Was it something that you knew, were they films that you connected with often?
Yes, definitely. And I mean, I can't sing at all, but you wouldn't know that from when I was a child. I used to sing Disney songs nonstop.
I mean, a kid growing up in the 90s in the middle of the Disney Renaissance with Beauty and the Beast and Aladdin. Of course, I think anybody who grew up with those films probably spent a lot of time singing them very badly in their little childhood voices. And then what's been your relationship with Disney as you've grown up and become an adult? Has it continued? Has it disappeared and waned and then come back? Or is it something that you've always kind of turned to?
It's something very comforting. So it's something that I'll turn to if I just really need to chill out and I need a little bit of cheering out or zoning out time, then I'll switch on a Disney film. Not very frequently anymore, but it is, it's something for a very rainy day.
I mean, this is probably quite a strange question, but has your, relationship with Disney in any capacity had any impact on your work as an artist? Have any of the principles or ideas or textures of those films or your memories of those films had an influence on the work that you've done?
Yeah, a little bit. Sometimes. Sometimes I'll remember the way a character was in a Disney film acting, and particularly Meg from Hercules.
The first person to bring up Meg on this podcast has taken too long. She's fabulous.
Isn't she? She's amazing. And I remember the first time I had to play a kind of a sexy character and I was a bit young. And I actually watched Hercules and I watched her because I just thought the way she moved and spoke and stood and was ideal for what I was preparing.
Because, I mean, her sexiness as a character comes from her confidence, like her kind of fuck you confidence, I'm going to be whoever it is I want to be. That's a great place to start.
Yeah.
It's one of the least problematic characters you probably could have chosen to start with. In the mid-1950s, two major rivals to Walt Disney Animation had stepped forward. One was the madcap anarchy of the Warner Brothers Looney Tunes cartoons. But the far more pertinent threat to Disney than Bugs Bunny or Daffy Duck was United Pictures of America, UPA. Established by artists who had left Disney following the 1941 strike, the small company was now widely acclaimed for its strong graphic style and popular characters, such as Mr. Magoo, more in line with post-war sensibilities than Mickey or Donald. They were winning awards, garnering respect, and connecting with audiences, and making Disney look old-fashioned. Critics even began to cite UPA when pointing out the inadequacies in Disney's work. This was something Walt would not stand for. He could not accept being shown up by, as he put it, those commies down the river, and was determined to win back his dominance. One tactic was to beat them at their own game, adopting a similar style to UPA with the Oscar-winning short Toot Whistle Plunk and Boom. The other would be a feature film that would launch a full-scale attack on UPA, something their modern style and limited resources could never, ever hope to achieve. In the process, it should, once and for all, firmly establish Disney Animation as the finest animation studio there had ever been. As he had with his only two past successes, Walt would once again turn to a classic fairy tale. But where Snow White and Cinderella were charming and intimate, this film would be enormous, on a scale never before attempted in animation. With Sleeping Beauty, Walt Disney and his artists, who had spent decades aiming for unachievable perfection, would finally achieve it, and in the process, bring Disney Animation to its knees. At the celebration for the newly born Princess Aurora, the three good fairies, Flora, Fauna, and Merryweather, come to bless the baby with gifts. But before they can finish, the evil fairy Maleficent, offended at not being invited, places a curse on Aurora that on her 16th birthday, she will prick her finger on the spindle of a spinning wheel and die. Merryweather dampens the curse so that she will only fall into a deep sleep instead until true love's kiss will break the spell. But as extra precaution, the three fairies take baby Aurora to a cottage in the woods and disguise themselves and her, foregoing magic to protect her identity from Maleficent. 16 years later, Aurora is told of her heritage and, shocked and devastated, is brought back to the castle. Before the sun sets, though, Maleficent finally completes her curse, and Aurora falls into a deep sleep. To make sure Aurora will never awaken, Maleficent kidnaps a young man Aurora has fallen in love with in the woods, only to discover, by an extraordinary coincidence, that the young man is Prince Philip, the prince betrothed to Aurora at birth. She locks Philip inside her castle on the Forbidden Mountain, but the three fairies rescue him. And after a titanic battle, where Maleficent surrounds Aurora with a forest of thorns and transforms into a dragon, Philip defeats Maleficent, awakens Aurora, and they marry, living happily ever after. As with Snow White and Cinderella, the origins of the fairy tale we know as Sleeping Beauty are rooted in European folklore. The earliest versions of the story date back to the 1300s, but the version we now know originates from Charles Perrault's Stories or Tales of Past Times with Morals, published in 1697, adapted from a version by Jean-Baptiste Basili from 1643. Though the Disney film is credited to the Perrault version of the story, it only adapts the first half, leaving off at the point where the prince awakens the sleeping princess. It also resembles the more popular version of the story from the Brothers Grimm from 1812, which streamlines Perrault's version. While all Disney animated features, until this point, had been working from ideas in development since the late 1930s and early 1940s, Sleeping Beauty was the first project fully developed in the post-war era. Flush with the success of Cinderella, the story team at Disney decided to pursue another classic fairy tale. In November 1950, Walt Disney announced the start of development on the film, and in 1951, work began on adapting the story, led by screenwriter Erdman Penner. These early versions attempted to retain the entirety of Perrault's story, mixing in action sequences for the prince that had been left over from Snow White. Wilfred Jackson stepped in as director in 1953 and began overseeing the first Laika reel, with storyboard shot and dialogue recorded. During that time in 1952, artist Kai Nielsen, who had been one of the primary artists during the Golden Age, returned to Disney. And though he left only a few months later, completed a number of storyboard concepts that would guide the look of the final film. When Walt saw the reel, he was unimpressed. The team went back to the drawing board, deciding that the better climax for the film would be the kiss that awakened the princess, and jettisoning the second half. The problem now was that there was no relationship between the two romantic leads, who wouldn't meet until the end. Instead, they condensed the story device that had the princess sleeping for 100 years and orchestrated a moment where the two meet in the woods, not knowing who each other are. The prince they named Philip, and the princess they named Aurora, Latin for dawn, which was the name of her daughter in the original fairy tale and her own in Tchaikovsky's ballet. In December 1953, Wilfred Jackson suffered a heart attack and was no longer able to continue on the project. In a surprising move, Walt appointed Eric Larson, one of the Nine Old Men, as director of the film. It was also at this time that Walt's ambitions for the film began to form. He instructed Larson that he wanted the film to have a single unifying visual look, to be a moving illustration, the ultimate in animation. And though a tentative release date was set for 1957, he told Larson that he didn't care how long it would take. He also decided that the film would follow in the footsteps of the soon-to-be-released Lady and the Tramp and be developed for the widescreen process. Rather than CinemaScope, though, they would be the first to use the Technirama 70mm process, which offered an even wider frame and higher resolution, making it the first animated film ever made for the enormous 70mm format. Sleeping Beauty would also satisfy one of Walt's great frustrations during the Silver Age. He had been enamored by Mary Blair's color stylings and concept art, but try as they might, the animators could never fully translate her style to the final film intact. What was the point of having such incredible concept artists if the films themselves didn't reflect their work? Sleeping Beauty would be different. There would be nothing lost in the translation, and the medieval textures that were already being developed for the film would not be diluted by the traditional Disney style. This would not be animation as entertainment, this would be animation as art. For the first time, Walt Disney handed full creative control of the film over to a single person, not one of his nine old men, but a painter and background artist whose work on Sleeping Beauty would make him a legend in the story of Disney animation, Ivan Earle. Do you remember the very first time that you saw this film in particular?
No, I do not remember. I would have been quite young. It wasn't a DVD that I owned. So I think it was one that we went down to the, you know, Video Easy and hired it.
Do you remember what your impression of it was as a kid? Like, was it one of the films that you came to often, or was it one that you just kind of occasionally would pick up off the shelf and hire out?
It was more that along the lines of Snow White as well. They were ones that I watched and I enjoyed the sort of the voices almost, like very comforting 50s voices, aren't they?
Very carefully calibrated, pleasant voice. Even Maleficent's voice is surprisingly comforting.
Well, I do like her voice. Is she also the stepmother in Cinderella?
Yes, yep, that's the same. Eleanor Audley, it's the same actor. So she's basically played two of the greatest villains in Disney animation.
In fact, actually, I think stepmother and Maleficent would be very good character starting points for something. The way they move as well and the way she looks, she always turns her head in a certain way.
There's a great, both of them have this great poise and regalness. I think that's maybe one of the reasons why, I mean, we'll get into about Maleficent properly later, but I mean, just as a comparison between the two characters, that they have such a sense of poise makes them so unnerving. They're not crones. They're not, you know, it's similar to, you know, the queen in Snow White, that, you know, when she, before she turns herself into a crone, there's something so collected and poised and dangerous about her, in her stillness, really. And like, particularly the stepmother in Cinderella, she's so still for so much of the film that you never quite know what she's going to do. And that puts you on edge, both as an audience member, but also in fear of what's going to happen to, you know, Cinderella at any point.
Yeah. My boss, David McAllister, has always said, you know, don't underestimate the power of stillness.
Absolutely, absolutely. And so when you, so coming to the film again for this chat, what was your response to it? First of all, we'll talk about your response as a dancer in a bit, but as an audience member, what was your response to revisiting the film now?
I think I liked it a lot more, actually. You know, as a kid, it wasn't sort of as exciting as Aladdin, I think. I know, I loved that. And there weren't as many songs. As a child, that's not necessarily what appealed to me. But as an adult, I think I prefer that. And I also enjoyed the animations a lot more. I really enjoyed the medieval look of it, especially the section in the forest. I thought the forest scene was particularly beautiful.
Which one would hope, considering it nearly killed everybody working on the film, to do that one bit? Because I'd always heard there was one scene in Sleeping Beauty that had nearly driven everybody working on it insane. And I always assumed it was like the dragon fight or, you know, the spinning wheel moment or that kind of stuff. And then I was like, you know, it's Aurora and Philip meeting in the woods. And then you look at it through that context and you're like, that's insane. Like, that sequence is insane. Like, that the human hands made that is absolutely nuts.
Yeah, it's very impressive.
And so as a dancer, and also as a dancer who has danced the role of Aurora, what was your general impression of the film through that lens? We'll go into talking more detail about the music and the relationship that the film has with the ballet in particular, but yeah, what was your impression of it through the eyes of a dancer?
I very much enjoyed the little bits of dancing that she did, especially with the owl in the cloak. Yeah, I quite enjoyed seeing the actual sort of dance ballet steps they put in there. It's interesting, like looking at her character, having played the character. It's not a character that's full of a lot of substance. I think. But I quite like the way that she looks in the film. She doesn't look like a very young, you know, naive girl. She has a sweetness to her, but she does also have a bit of a fiery sort of edge to her.
There's a tremendous amount of weight to Aurora in the film, like gravitas to her. Like, you know, she doesn't look like she's 16. She looks like she would be a woman in her, you know, the most elegant woman imaginable in her late, you know, mid to late 20s. Like she has this feeling of a character who has lived in some capacity. There isn't the kind of, you know, Snow White is so kind of flippant in her actions. She's so much a little child. And Cinderella is this, you know, by her very nature is kind of like this crushed, subdued young woman. But there is, yeah, Aurora walks on and she has a regalness to her that's immediately arresting.
Yeah, which I don't really know how she developed that, having, you know, being brought up in the forest by three fairies.
I rewatched it this morning, and there's this point where the fairies are making the dress and the cake for her birthday, and Meriwether says, "You can't sew, and Fauna's never cooked before." And all I thought to myself was, all this after having watched this film, ever as long as I can remember, the first time I actually went, so what the fuck have they done for the past 16 years? Like, how have they fed themselves? How have they clothed themselves? How have they brought up a baby in this environment? And a baby that's turned out to be so, like, relatively well-grounded as Aurora is.
Yeah, I actually thought the exact same thing. How have they not used magic for the past 16 years?
Exactly. Like, they, you know, and also they're wearing exactly the same clothes. How have the clothes? I mean, obviously we're digging into a fairy tale, and like the great thing about Sleeping Beauty is that of all the fairy tale films, it is the most grounded in the traditions and ideas and textures of fairy tales. But there is, yeah, there's the thing of like, you know, she can't sew, she can't cook. Then what on earth have you been doing with this baby all this time? I want to also ask about Aurora in the ballet as well. So talk to me about what kind of character is Aurora in the original ballet, and what was the experience like having to bring her to life in the production that you did?
Initially, Aurora is a much less sort of poised and elegant than Aurora is in the film. In the ballet, we tend to play her as a 16-year-old girl, and she actually doesn't come in until there's a sort of a prologue scene, and then there's act one, which is Aurora's birthday party as a 16-year-old. And she comes in and she's full of excitement because it's her party and she has the most beautiful tutu on. And then she meets these four princes that she's has to pick one of. And you sort of have this naivety and innocence to her, and she doesn't know what to do. She's so overwhelmed. She doesn't really know who to pick, or, you know, she doesn't really take it very seriously. And so she has a lot of growing up to do, which she does by the end of the ballet. Falling asleep for 100 years does a lot for her maturity. And so it's not until the end of the ballet that we sort of become more similar to the Disney movie, how they portray her.
What was your response then to, you know, the difference between that naivety that Aurora has in the ballet and that very, because I mean, that's an arc that she has to follow in the ballet of going from innocence to experience, from being childhood to adulthood. The strange thing about Aurora in the Disney Sleeping Beauty is that she doesn't really have an arc. She kind of, you know, she does, her arc is to be devastated, really. Like she learns, she has the moment of learning that her entire life is not what she thought it was. It all collapses. She falls asleep, wakes up, and there's Philip. That, you know, she doesn't have as huge a learning curve in the film as she does in the ballet.
Similar in the ballet in that, as I say, most of the learning she does when she's asleep. But we do have Act Two, which is a dream sequence. And in a way, she sort of does her maturing then, and that's sort of when she meets her prince in the dream sequence. But, yeah, it's sort of quite easy to play the mature Aurora, having grown from the naive one, and it's also a very musical thing. The music in Act Three of the ballet is a lot more imperial and a lot more somber than it is in Act One. So you are very much led by that as well.
Little princess, my gift shall be the gift of beauty.
In the early 1950s, Disney artist John Hench visited the Metropolitan Museum of Art in New York and was particularly taken by what he saw in the Cloisters, their medieval gallery. He took photographs of the famous unicorn tapestries, a series of seven ornate tapestries from 16th century France depicting a hunt for the mythical unicorn. When Hench showed the photographs to Walt, Walt decided that this would be an interesting direction to take for the now-in-development Sleeping Beauty. Walt was wary of repeating himself and was determined to find a new, distinct direction from those in Snow White and Cinderella. Kai Nielsen was the first artist to develop these ideas into story sketches, but he only returned to the studio for a short period. Around this time, artist Ivan Earl began working at the studio as a background painter. Before joining the studio in 1951, Earl had carved himself a modestly successful career as an artist, with works displayed in New York, including at the Met. His work had initially leaned towards realism, but while at Disney, he started to develop a style of his own, marrying modernism with medieval or Gothic art. His work at Disney began as an assistant background painter on Peter Pan, but what caught Walt's attention was his background work on the Goofy short For Whom the Bulls Toil. He also contributed a number of remarkable background artworks for Lady and the Tramp and was the colour stylist for Toot, Whistle, Plunk and Boom. With Mary Blair now having left the studio to pursue her own art career, Walt began to pin his hopes for a new holistic Disney style on Ivan Earl. Walt appointed Earl as the colour stylist on Sleeping Beauty, but in a surprising move, declared that he would be the primary visual artist on the film, overseeing every aspect of its look, including the characters and animation. No single artist had ever been given this level of autonomy on a Disney feature before, but Walt was determined that nothing of Earl's style would be lost in the final film. He wanted Sleeping Beauty to be a true epic, a complete and overwhelming theatrical experience that demonstrated the full artistic power of animation. This meant that the film could not rely on cute characters and charming whimsy. They needed to elevate their craft so that the artistic possibilities of animation, and in particular Disney animation, would be inarguable. Earl turned to pre-Renaissance and medieval art for inspiration, not just from Europe, but from Persia and the Middle East. He was drawn to a series of Persian Gothic miniature paintings, whose flat geometric style kept everything within the frame in full focus. Another source would be The Very Rich Hours of the Duke of Berry, a beautifully illustrated prayer book from 1410. For Sleeping Beauty, Earl proposed a complete synthesis between character and environment, so that, rather than there being two opposing styles, the background artwork and the animation, the former serving the latter, they would exist in harmony with one another. He also moved away from the principles in background art developed by Tyrus Wong and Claude Coates, and demanded that every element of the image be in focus at the same time, just as in medieval art.
In searching for a style for a cartoon feature, many considerations are necessary. For one thing, it must be more than merely pleasing to the eye. The backgrounds must harmonize with the animated characters, as well as fit the mood of the story and the music. Sleeping Beauty is a fairy tale that is supposed to have taken place long, long ago. So we did a great amount of research into medieval painting and architecture before we arrived at the right styling for this picture.
Almost instantly, the animators expressed reservations. The artworks being created by Earl were bursting with intricate detail and geometric lines. They were worried that the characters would disappear into the backgrounds, especially if the same principles were applied to the animation itself, and that the sharp geometric style that Earl was insisting upon wouldn't be as appealing to the audience as the more rounded classic Disney style. At first, many of the artists were excited by the challenges and ideas proposed in Earl's stylings, but that excitement was short-lived. Over the next few years, they would be forced to forego their individual idiosyncrasies and the principles of animation that had guided them for the last 20 years in subservience to Earl's vision. They were worried that the film would be too cold, too overwhelming, without any heart or charm. When they brought these concerns to Walt, though, he backed Ivan Earl. This was the approach he wanted to take, a serious and holistic one without the usual Disney gags. Walt had also become disconnected from the project, distracted by the demands of television and Disneyland. There wasn't even solace to be found from the directing team. Eric Larson stuck to Walt's demands and backed Earl. The film was originally slated for Christmas 1955, but was soon delayed until 1957. As work progressed, it became clear that the film couldn't possibly make that date either. By January 1957, after already 5 years of work, only 2,500 feet of film had been animated. There were still 3,800 feet left to go. Sleeping Beauty was out of control.
The perspective they used to take with the film of having the story told from the secondary character's points of view as opposed to the primary character. So we don't really, apart from the section in the forest, the story's not really told from Aurora's perspective. It's either told from the fairies or from Maleficent. What do you think about, what was your impression of the role that women were placed in within the narrative of this film? And certainly in comparison to the way that women would have been positioned within the narrative of the ballet or ballet storytelling in general.
Actually, interestingly, in the ballet, similarly, it's sort of told through the lilac fairy. Aurora, the lilac fairy, is the consistent one. And she is a lot stronger a character than any of the fairies in the movie. And I think that's what I found the most, is that the women in it, they sort of were a lot more, they had a lot more going for them than, say, the prince or the kings. For sure. But the fairies, I found a little bit, the good fairies, I thought they just sort of bumbled along in their goodness and somehow everything turned out okay, which doesn't show a lot of, you know, strength and wisdom. And then the other, you know, the evil Maleficent was just incredibly evil.
There's something very primal about the characters in the film. And like, you know, Maleficent's entire motivation is, I didn't get invited to a christening.
Yeah.
And then she holds on to that grudge for 16 years because she's like, no, but you didn't invite me to that christening. And also the fairies, they're three good fairies. Their job is to do good. They're the, you know, the good in the balance to Maleficent's evil. And the beautiful, there's such a beautiful simplicity to the characters in this film. If their function is just very direct. You know, Maleficent is no more complex than you pissed me off, you didn't invite me to a christening. And the fairies are simple as this baby does not deserve to suffer for these mistakes. We have to save and protect this baby. And that even the kind of form of the film where, you know, joking about, you know, what does happen in those 16 years, it's kind of the beauty of the fairy tale of, you know, where other versions of the story might try and fill out that time and kind of give you an idea of what's happened at that time. This film in its kind of simplicity just goes, no, what is important are the markers of the narrative that we're hitting and the simplicity of the character arcs that we're having to follow. The story has to, like, we're not going into complex storytelling with this one. We're just sticking to something that feels very relatable, easy to communicate and easy to connect with, which I guess compare what you were talking about before, of as a kid, it's not necessarily the most exciting film, but as an adult, you start to see something really kind of revolutionary in it. There isn't, you know, the bursting funny characters there would be in a film like Aladdin. It's not as easy a film to connect with when you're a kid. I mean, this was one of my favorite films as a kid, but I don't know many other people for whom that's the case. And that there is, you know, and maybe it's just simply the fact of these characters are so straightforward and direct.
Yeah. Well, as you say, it is very uncomplicated. And I just think, you know, as a woman, I'd really, you know, I start to want more from my women character, which you can't obviously expect from a fairy tale from the 50s. But I think that's the good thing about a ballet is that you can grow and nuance characters a little bit more.
Yes, because, I mean, this is one of those Disney films that's often brought up as one of the kind of problem films, because Aurora, I mean, Philip is more of a character than any other prince before him, but he's still not much of a character. And Aurora says probably less than any of the other Disney princesses, even though she has this kind of regal weight to her. But also the fact that it ends with Frank, you know, a non-consensual act of affection, and how complicated that is to look at through the lens of 2020, and how we deal with that in terms of how we approach this particular work of art now.
A lot less problematic, though, than the original fairy tale.
Well, yeah, well, that was my next question. When you were working on the ballet, were you going back to the original fairy tale at all?
I mean, personally, no. I did have a lot of fun research. Like, I did research it. Didn't necessarily add anything to my character. I did have a lot of fun reading these outrageous fairy tales.
It's nuts, the original fairy story version. Because also what we're getting is only the first half of the story. Like, I can't even remember what happens in the second half because it's just so batshit nuts.
It is. You know, I think she has children.
Doesn't she fall pregnant while she's asleep?
Well, that's one version, yes. And she wakes up to her child sucking on her finger, and the child has sucked out the thorn that she pricked her finger on. She wakes up with two children, and then this king comes along and sort of says, oh, yeah, sorry about that. I visited you while you were asleep.
Oh, wow. So glad that Disney decided not to go with that particular narrative thread.
It's a good version.
I mean, that's a question to ask. Why do you think Sleeping Beauty is a fairy tale that does persist? Like, is it the power of the original fairy tale on its own? Is it a massive influence of Tchaikovsky's ballet? Is it the influence of this particular telling of the story? Why do you think the Sleeping Beauty fairy tale is one that we keep finding ourselves coming back to?
I think it's the simplicity of it. Like, it's an absolute fairy tale. And because of that, there's sort of no real drama or anything to get, you know, complicated by. And so because of that, you can make it pure magic. And in the ballet, you sort of can add all these extra characters. They tend to add Red Riding Hood and all these characters from other fairy tales and put them in. So it's just a really simple, beautiful fairy tale. And of course the music, one of the most, you know, successful scores of Tchaikovsky's, in fact, a lot more successful at the time than anything else.
What are some of the important qualities of, but not even talking about it in relation to this film, but just the ballet on its own, what are some of the important qualities to note about Tchaikovsky's ballet? Because by comparison to something like Swan Lake, Sleeping Beauty seems even bigger and grander an achievement than even that, you know, that ballet.
Yeah, I think it's incredible the amount of thought that went into every single bit of this score. Apparently it's a lot more of a refined score compared to Swan Lake. It was done 12 years, I believe it was 12 years, might have been six, after Swan Lake.
Which makes sense because there's such a desperation to the music in Swan Lake. Like, it feels like an artist kind of exorcising something out of them, the same as like his Romeo and Juliet overture. That there's kind of like, you can hear the torture in Tchaikovsky. That's not as present in Sleeping Beauty. That the Sleeping Beauty is kind of almost like an artist kind of flying, like just letting everything go, like in complete command of his abilities.
Yeah, and he used all those abilities to tell the story in his music. And so everything from the first keys that he used to introduce Good as the Lilac Fairy, which was E major, and then he went to E minor to introduce the evil, and then E flat to introduce humanity into it. So, like, the most incredible amount of thought. And then there's a variation, a fairy variation, where it's sometimes called the Jewel Fairy. And it's set in a time signature of a 5-4 to, imply the five-sided diamond, the cut. Tiny little things like that, which are just incredible.
And what did you, when then coming to this film where the ballet, like a ballet that you've danced and a ballet that you're very, musically very familiar with, to then have that music adapted in this way for the film, what was your first impressions on hearing Sleeping Beauty in the film?
Well, I found it really interesting which parts they chose to turn into the film score. The reason I found it so interesting was that actually none of the music that Aurora dances to were in the film.
Really?
Yeah, which I found fascinating. I mean, little bits possibly, like, you know, some sort of linking scenes, but none of her major moments made it into the film.
Why do you think that is, and why? What do you think the film loses or gains by doing that?
Oh, I think the film did beautifully. Like, I think the score is absolutely gorgeous. I don't, and it probably it may not have worked, because I guess a lot of her act one, as we were talking about before, how she is this in the ballet, quite a naive, excited young 16-year-old. She is never really that in the movie. It's probably not relevant. And then in act three, we never really see the wedding between the two. So I guess it's not, again, not relevant to have her variation, her wedding dance in there.
Do you think it's a respectful treatment of the music? Because, I mean, it's one thing to, you know, to take somebody else's music and readapt it for another form. It's quite another thing to take one of the great masterpieces of 19th and 20th century music and refashion it to your own devices for a cartoon. Do you think the score serves the film, that serves the original music well?
I think so. I think they did a beautiful job, and I think you have to simplify it so much for film. That in a ballet, you have so much more. It's a 3-hour score, but there is no talking, so the music has to do the talking for us. Whereas in the film, I guess it's more of a background. The one thing I did find very interesting was that they used the Puss in Boots cat variation for Maleficent whenever she was on.
Really?
Yeah.
I guess that makes a certain degree of sense, because now I think about it, that music does sound like a cat. It has the kind of movements and, you know, energies of a cat. That's very, I mean, and I guess that is appropriate for a character like Maleficent, who has this kind of this dangerous, unpredictable quality to her.
Yeah, I think so. I think it actually worked really well. And I actually really love that about Tchaikovsky's music, is that one version isn't necessarily all you can hear in music. So we do a couple of different versions of Swan Lake, and they're very different. And the music can seem frantic and desperate, or it can seem good, or it can seem evil, all in the one section, just depending on how you interpret it. And I think that's the brilliance of Tchaikovsky as well.
Well, I mean, that question from that then is, how do you go about creating character and narrative from a piece of music? I mean, like, you know, because that's a fascinating question in terms of creating ballet, but also in relation to this film, because, you know, they credit the Charles Perrault fairy tale as the source material, but it's very clear the ballet itself is also acting as a major source for what this film is, because of the prevalence of the music. How do you create a character and a story from a piece of music?
Well, I believe it takes about 3 years. That's the thing that takes the most amount of time, is to create, you know, find which parts of the music you want to tell your story. Our version of Sleeping Beauty is very traditional, yet they still had to make some cuts. So they had to work out which sections were absolutely important to that story and why. It's a big job.
Which I guess is a similar process that you can see happening in this film, because it's the thing that's quite, apart from the fact that there is no other Disney film, certainly up until this point, that has an orchestral score of the size of this. Like, that's the thing that's so striking. Of course, the visuals of the film are gargantuan, but they're added extra weight by just how big this music is. And the thing that's so surprising and kind of thrilling about watching the film is how symbiotic the relationship is between the action of the film and the music, much more than any other Disney animated film up until this point, like even down to the fact of, like, on an accent of music, Aurora's coat will drop, or on an accent of music, like, you know, Maleficent will drop her staff. You can kind of see that relation, that similar kind of relationship of going, well, it can't just be haphazard. We have to put thought into What does this musical moment mean? What does it mean in terms of the impact for the audience, the impact for the characters, the rhythm of the piece itself? It's thrilling to see that in an animated form, which I guess we just want to talk about, you know, this symbiosis between the music and the visuals. Watching the film, how much do you think the music is influencing what it is they choose to show us? Not just in terms of action, but just the look of the film, like this medieval tapestry quality to it. How much does the music add to that texture in the film?
Oh, it adds everything to it. I mean, I don't know if I'm just so used to that, as you say, the symbiosis between the music and the story, but it certainly appeals to me. To me, it just gives everything a richness. It makes the landscape richer, which in this particular film, in that forest scene, I just thought the landscape was incredibly rich and intricate and detailed, and that is just matched perfectly by the music, or it matches the music perfectly.
And it also matches beautifully with how simple the narrative and the characters are. I mean, it's that thing of we were talking about earlier about the idea of telling a story through music and the body, music and visuals, is kind of one of the other striking things about this film is how little dialogue there is in it. I mean, there's a substantial enough to be able to tell the story, but there are whole sections where the last 15 minutes of the film, the dialogue just falls away. The whole sequence where Aurora is going up the tower to prick her finger, and Philip's escape and the fight with the dragon, dialogue just almost disappears, and it just becomes about telling a story through visual, like the visuals, the physical action, and the music. And it's quite thrilling to see how much all of those elements just click together. The way that I imagine it would be to watch human bodies in motion in a ballet, which I guess is, in that sense, the choice to use Tchaikovsky's music means that, in a way, Sleeping Beauty has to function similar to the way that a ballet or a dance would have to function, because the music was written for that purpose, and the film has to adapt to that purpose.
Yes, it's only in my dreams. But they say if you dream a thing more than once, it's sure to come true. And I've seen him so many times.
Over the course of our episodes on the Silver Age of Disney animation, we're looking at each of the 9 old men, the core team of animators that defined the classic Disney style, and at their individual contributions to the art of animation. In this episode, we look at the man who inspired and mentored the next generation of great animators to follow, Eric Larson. Eric Larson was born in Cleveland, Utah on September 5, 1905. The son of Danish immigrants. After majoring in journalism from the University of Utah, Larson built a strong reputation as a humorist and cartoonist, and worked as a freelance artist. In 1933, after encouragement from a friend, he submitted his work to Walt Disney Productions and was hired as an assistant animator. Larson joined Disney at the height of the Silly Symphonies series, and within a few years had been promoted to animator. During this time, he was mentored by some of the legendary Golden Age animators, in particular Hamilton Lusk. He instilled in Larson strong principles of caricature, sincerity, and action, all of which would become trademark qualities of Larson's work. With the move into features, Larson worked on every single one of the Golden Age films, animating Figaro in Pinocchio and acting as supervising animator on the Pastoral Symphony in Fantasia and on Bambi. Much of his work during the films in the 30s and 40s focused on animal characters, imbuing them with a strong sense of humour, personality, and empathy, and anarchy, in the case of the Araquan in The Three Caballeros. But by the Silver Age, Larson had become an expert in female characters, co-supervising Cinderella with Mark Davis, as well as Alice, Wendy, and Lady. When Walt appointed him one of the sequence directors on Sleeping Beauty, it was an acknowledgement of his particular skill and his strong attention to detail, necessary to achieving the demands of Ivan Earle. Perhaps Larson's greatest contribution to Disney animation, though, on par with his incredible draftsmanship and artistry, was his mentorship of the artists that would follow the 9 old men. In 1973, with the studio struggling to find its footing after the death of Walt, Larson established a training program to bring fresh artists to Disney. Many of those who were part of the program, including Ron Clements, John Musker, Glenn Keane, Don Bluth, Andreas Degas, John Lasseter, Brad Bird, and Tim Burton, would be among the most important animators and filmmakers at the end of the 20th century and into the 21st.
Eric was the person that I first met when I applied for a job here. And Eric, to me, is just the answer to everything. And he can help you with your drawing, or he can help you with why you can't work that day. You have artist block. Eric, I can't draw. I haven't been able to draw for a week. And somehow he has a way of working you out of it. Basically, whenever I need help with anything, I come here.
He always reminds me of just the fundamental things that I tend to forget. You know, it's like animation's so complex, and how many drawings are in there and stuff, but Eric always comes back to, like, what does the audience perceive?
The fact that he stayed here all these, he doesn't need to be here, but it's his love for what the medium can be. And, you know, and what he sees in us as people and what he can give us, it keeps him around.
Working with the younger animators has been a great lift. It's part of the studio. And to see a new staff developed, and they are developing fast. We've got some wonderful young people coming along. This has to be a source of satisfaction. And there's something about young people that helps to keep you young, or helps to keep me young, even though I don't look it, but the spirit is there.
Larson retired in 1986, having finished his time at Disney as animation consultant on The Fox and the Hound, The Black Cauldron, and The Great Mouse Detective, the first film directed by his students Musker and Clements. By the time he left the studio, he was the longest-standing employee in the studio's history, having contributed to films, shorts, and television at Disney for over 50 years. Speaking of Larson, Musker wrote how he found the essential truth, warmth, and sincerity of whatever character he animated. When he passed away in October 1988, at the age of 83, he left behind a legacy not only found in the pencil lines of many of the great Disney animated films of the past, but the pencil lines and pixels of the great films to come. To kind of segue into talking about the other characters a bit. So Maleficent is kind of a giant in Disney villains. Why do you think we love her so much?
Well, I think they absolutely aced her in terms of, like, her look. She's, because I think also, I mean, personally, I think I love a really beautiful villain, and there she does have that poise and elegance. You know, she's not, you know, she's quite appealing to look at, which is why you can understand how she could be so evil and manipulative.
And she has the most striking silhouette, like those, the horns and the cloak, and even just the color choices of combining like purple and yellow. It's just like, and green, there's just something so unnervingly enticing about that.
Yeah, and also I love dragons, so you can turn into a dragon.
And that final sequence is one of the most nuts things I think I've ever seen in an animated film. Like, it's been one of the most interesting things about doing this project chronologically, because I've watched Sleeping Beauty hundreds of times, always fell in love with it. It's quite something to watch it after having just watched Lady and the Tramp, the film that came just before it, and to see the enormous leap. I mean, there's something so intensely cinematic about the film, about the way the visual storytelling and the rhythms of it, which I guess is another reason why Maleficent is such a cinematic villain. It's the kind, like, you could never do that. It's, you know, it was interesting seeing Angelina Jolie play Maleficent in a live-action film. It just didn't have the same impact. It doesn't have the same impact to see this thing, this is a real living thing. It's, you know, the kind of graphic, you know, the giant graphic impact of her is so considerable that to kind of try and render it in any other form other than the form that she's seen in the film, particularly when combined with, you know, the background art and the other characters and the music, she just feels relatively inadequate.
I agree with them. Most of the real Disney versions, I miss the theatricality of the animation.
Yes, because it's like achieving things you can't achieve with live, like, and that's one of the things that's where Sleeping Beauty really sticks out, is that you're seeing things that are not possible to do within a frame, within a real a frame of live action filmmaking. You can't have a shift in color like that, or a shift in focus like that, or you can't have an angle that works like that, or you can't have moments of stillness like that. There are so many incredible shots where, you know, a character's not moving and it's simply a shift in light and color and sound. And that, if you tried that with a live action actor, that would never be as effective. It's like you're watching a frame of art, like a framed artwork, literally moving before your eyes at every single point in the film.
Do you think it would be really difficult or easy for them to change the dress from blue to pink at the very end? Is that a simple thing to do?
You know, you mean when it's the book, when they're zooming out of the book at the end?
Yeah, or no, just the, when they're dancing around and it's just pink.
I think changing it within the animation itself probably would have been relatively straightforward, because it's just, you know, you're doing it at 24 frames per second, so you're simply just like shifting the color through that. I have no idea how they do the book at the end.
Yeah.
I'm looking for the where you can see them cut from one shot to the next, like within the shot. I'm looking for the trick, but I can't see it. I can't see the shift in it. It's really frustrating as someone, and but also kind of magical at the same time. And I mean, that also speaks to just what a feat this film is. I mean, it just, you know, like we were saying before, like you look at it and just like, how did a human being make this? How did a human being put their, like, a pencil to a piece of paper and start conceiving of the entirety of this? Which kind of brings me to the other conversation and question I had. Because ballet as an art form is such a pursuit for perfection. I mean, you know, it's the two greatest elements that we have as human beings, our bodies and the ability to make beautiful sound. Why do you think we feel the need to want to kind of aim for something like that, to aim for perfection, when we know that perfection is essentially a thing that is either impossible to achieve or accidental? Why have these artistic pursuits that go for something impossible?
Well, because I think it's impossible to achieve it for yourself, yet I feel like I have witnessed perfection in other people.
What does that look like? What does a moment of perfection look like to witness?
Ooh, well, it's that complete sort of unity of technical brilliance, as well as being completely believing that that person is what they are saying they are. And then you are just sort of swept away. You're not conscious of anything but that moment.
Do you think that perfection is a thing that can be manufactured, or is it a thing that is out of our hands as human beings that happens, that just has to happen?
I think it just has to happen. There's way too many things that can go wrong at any single point. Yeah, it sort of just happens.
Particularly imagine when a human body is involved. I mean, I guess that's something that I imagine must be quite terrifying as an artist for whom your body is your primary tool of communication and, you know, expression, that it is a thing that is fallible and, you know, has the potential to, you know, potential to give up on you at any given moment.
It's less about it completely giving up, but honestly, everything just changes every single moment. There is so much to control. And then you have the costumes to worry about. And
is that a careful kind of balance and consideration between yourself and the costume designers, yourself and the set designers, of being able to make sure?
No, I would say they don't care.
Really?
Costume designers, no. The people who build our costumes, who make the costumes, our wardrobe department, they care, and they create the most incredible costumes, and they always try to make it so that we can actually dance. And they try and sort of side with us when they're speaking to the designers, saying, oh, that, you know, the dancers won't like that. They won't, nope, they cannot dance if they've got a 20-meter train. You know, so the designers don't necessarily care, but the wardrobe and our production staff generally try and make it functional for us.
Well, I guess that brings me to my next question, which is, what do you think is the cost of pursuing perfection? Like, you know, what are the stakes for it if one fails? And what are we willing to give up in order to be able to achieve it?
For a dancer, I guess sometimes the mental cost of trying to achieve perfection can be quite high. it's hard. It's really hard mentally. It's hard when you do fail because, you know, failure is inevitable. You're never going to be 100% happy with every show. And when we do about 200 shows a year, that's a lot of times to not feel good about yourself. Yeah, I think there is a cost mentally. I mean, elite athletes go through the same thing. You're constantly constantly pushing yourself, and the sort of personalities that can achieve that often are in sort of elite art forms or sports or any sort of industry, they tend to be, you know, maybe possibly a little anxious, a little obsessive, a little quite hard on themselves. So you really have to find the balance.
Do you think that those qualities are necessary? Like, is in order to be an artist, and I mean this, you know, in speaking specifically of ballet, but I think this extends to every single art form, including putting a pencil to a piece of paper and creating a, you know, a piece of animation at 24 frames per second. Do you think the qualities of obsessiveness and dedication and willingness to kind of sacrifice so much of who you are and what it is that you do in order to achieve that perfection, do you think that's a quality that's necessary to be able to do that?
I don't think it's necessary for everyone, but I think it's necessary for the majority. I think there are always going to be people who are just so exceptional that they don't necessarily have to have that level of obsession. But I think they would potentially be the minority.
Do you think it's worth it?
Yes, because those few moments that you do achieve what you're trying to achieve and you do manage to lose yourself and you do, those moments are what make it absolutely worth it.
And what do those moments feel like, to ask you a giant, deeply, deeply personal question? What are those moments where you hit it? What does that moment feel like?
Afterwards, it feels absolutely amazing, but it's like not being conscious of what you're doing. Yeah, you stop thinking, and that's sort of the best thing about it, where you stop thinking artificially and you just either become the character or you are, you know, at one with the music or at one with the movement. It's not conscious.
I've always thought about, because, I mean, being a theatre director, you know, it's that thing of, you know, trying to reach impossible perfection that you know you'll never reach, but you're trying anyway. And it's thinking, like, you know, trying to help other people to achieve that as well. And the way I've always thought about it is, you know, you've reached it when you can hear what the universe sounds like. It's like being able to hear the heartbeat of the universe for a fleeting second, because all of the things that you have, everything you've done has kind of clicked into place. And not just in terms of the work that you make yourself as an artist, but also when you see other artists create a work where you can see that. It's like, you know, when I listen to The Rite of Spring, I feel like I can hear the heartbeat of the universe for a fleeting second within that, the cacophony of that music. Or even, to be honest, there are moments when I watch Sleeping Beauty, probably more so than any of the, like, it's not my favorite Disney film. It's up there as one of my favorites, but probably more so than any of them, there are moments in this film where I look at it and I go, ah, there it is. Like, this film is, by sheer force of will and desperation and insanity, reaching for something it knows it cannot possibly reach, but is so determined to reach it. And you suddenly go, oh, that's what it is to be alive. That's what it is to exist. In fleeting moments of animation with fairies and cute forest animals and all that crap, there are just these fleeting glimpses in this film where you see something impossible. And I mean, kind of one of the last questions I wanted to ask is, because the thing, when this film is brought up in conversation with people who love it, or people who, you know, people who have reverence for it as a work of animation, it's always talked about as being perfect. Like, you know, it's a film that is technically perfect, emotionally perfect. You know, it has that, it is something impossible, an impossible creation. I don't necessarily always think that's the case with it. But I guess I wanted to ask, under those principles of what you were talking about, do you think this is a film that at any point achieves some kind of perfection?
Yeah, I think so. I still keep going back to the meeting scene in the bush, in the forest. Yeah, I think it achieves everything, and it's the music that also drives that.
What about that moment in particular? Like, what about that moment sticks out for you? What about that moment when you look at it and think about it, just go, yeah, that's it. That's the moment.
I think it's that part of me that loves the romance and that thought that this prince has just literally walked out of your dream into reality. And that's, for me, the dancing together, because that's how I connect with people. It's the absolute beauty of the where they are and the music.
There's something so deeply genuine about that moment. And it's funny because, you know, when Snow White sees the prince singing from the wall and she falls instantly in love with him, and it's like, you are literally hundreds of meters apart. You probably can't even see each other properly. You're never going to see each other again until he wakes you up a bit later. And then Cinderella, she meets the prince at the ball, and it's just the kind of like love at first sight blink moment. But there's such a negotiation between Aurora and Philip. It is a thing of like, you know, she says, I've been dreaming of this perfect man. And then he appears, and her response is, what the fuck? Like, it's not instantaneous. And also, we get to finally, for the first time in a Disney film, we get to actually see the prince's reasoning behind that. He hears this voice, goes, there's something about this voice. I feel like I've heard it before. And then they meet. And you're completely like, the only way they can properly, fully express how they feel about each other in this moment that neither of them understand, and very clearly neither of them understand, is to dance. They stop singing and they come together and they dance, like that astounding shot of them dancing along the riverbank. And it's like there's something so carefully negotiated about that exchange. I guess it's one of the reasons why this feels like one of the least problematic of the Disney fairy tale princess stories, because it frames itself as the simplicity of a fairy tale, and so that you can have like the slightly complex negotiations between Aurora and Philip make a lot more impact. It feels like what we imagine love to be, not some ridiculous thing of seeing a prince over a wall and going, I'll marry him one day, or meeting a prince at a ball you've never spoken to and going, I'll marry him one day. There's not a moment where they look at each other and go, I will marry you one day. It's just a thing of, oh, you're it.
Yeah.
You've literally been the one I've been dreaming of.
I've known you forever.
Yeah. And even like the way they come together at the end when they're walking down the stairs and there's they don't say anything. And I guess they probably don't say anything because, you know, there's probably budget cuts and there's, you know, they can't afford to have them speak, or, you know, they're trying to cut back on the production because it's gone out of hand. But there's something really beautiful about the fact that they don't have to. When they come together, they don't have to say a word.
And that piece of music that they use for that is absolute perfection. That is actually the moment where Aurora is crowned in Act 3, when they're walking down the stairs together. And there is this, yeah, imperial sort of solemnity that, you know, expresses far more than what words could at that moment.
And to finish up on Sleeping Beauty, what are the lasting impressions that the film has left for you when revisiting it?
Actually, just some really lovely memories of when I did debut Aurora in 2017, and I was so nervous. But just before Aurora's entrance is the garland dance, which is what they use as Once Upon a Dream. And so I was able to just relax myself by singing that sort of music to myself, that song to myself, and just relaxing before I made this, you know, incredibly nerve-wracking entrance. And so it was really lovely. Watching the film again brought me back to that moment in 2017.
And how did it go when you stepped on stage? What was it like?
Oh, it was crazy. It went well. I don't remember. I've never been so tired. It's a very hard ballet.
The artists at Walt Disney Productions faced an impenetrable wall with Ivan Earle. They did not believe that his ambitious ideas would work, but he had the backing of not only Walt, but many of the key artists on the project. The animation staff rallied against the geometric principles being imposed by Earl and character designer Tom Oreb. The original designs for Aurora resembled the figure and shape of Audrey Hepburn, but Earl redesigned it to be, according to animator Ron Diaz, very angular, moving with more fluidity and elegance, but her design had a harder line. The edges of her dress became squarer, pointed even, and the back of her head came almost to a point rather than round and cuddly like the other Disney girls. It had to be done to complement the background. Frank Thomas and Ollie Johnson had already fought one battle with the design of the Three Good Fairies after Walt had suggested they all look and behave the same, and the two animators had argued to give them all distinct personalities. Now, they pushed back against the geometry of Oreb's designs, worried that such a sharp look would make them unsympathetic. In the end, they came to a compromise, melding the two principles together, and in the process, making Flora, Fauna, and Merriweather the characters closest to the classic Disney style. One animator who did get along with Earl was Mark Davis. The two men bonded over their shared love of modern art, and Davis was willing to adhere to Earl's principles when realizing Maleficent. He was inspired by Czechoslovakian religious paintings, and with her black and lavender colouring and striking horn silhouette, created the most powerful and dramatic of all the Disney villains.
I keep quite a large art library at home here, and I had a book I think was printed in Czechoslovakia on art of the Middle Ages in some ways, and there was a painting, a religious painting, and it was some character had on this black robe, and there was this pattern of material, and it looked like flames, and that intrigued me, so I used that as a part of it. And then with the collar and the points on there, it was kind of trying to get a bat look to her, and of course the horns, just because it's kind of the devil image, so she frightened everybody to half to death.
His only concern was the fact that Maleficent tended to deliver mostly soliloquies, with no other characters to bounce off from, so he added the Raven as her companion. As production continued to slouch forward, with no end in sight and Walt essentially disconnected from the project, the tension and stresses began to take a toll. Frank Thomas would complain to animation supervisor Ken Peterson, but was told that because of Walt's demands, nothing could be done. During production, Thomas developed a strange red sore on his face that refused to heal and needed to visit the doctor every week to have it seen to. Many of the cleanup animators were so paranoid about getting anything wrong that they were only producing one drawing a day, equating to 1 second of usable footage a month. When Walt finally did turn his attention back to Sleeping Beauty, he was horrified. He accused the artists of being too obsessed with detail rather than character, a similar complaint he had had on previous films, but this time they had been acting under his instructions. His greatest concern, though, was with Sequence 8, which covered Aurora and Philip's meeting in the woods and was being directed by Eric Larson. Walt had seen an early version of the sequence and had found it cold and dull, suggesting that they add some animals to lighten the mood. It was now a year later, though, and not only had the sequence not been completed thanks to Larson's insistence on perfection, but had completely blown its budget, costing over $10,000. Walt had no choice but to remove Larson as supervising director on Sleeping Beauty and redeploy him as an animator on other projects. Clyde Geronimi now stepped in as supervising director, with Wolfgang Reitherman and Les Clark brought on as sequence directors. Geronimi instantly began to clash with Ive and Earl over creative differences. In his interview with Michael Barrier and Milton Gray in 2015, Geronimi said that Earl's artwork lacked the mood in a lot of things. All that beautiful detail in the trees, the bark and all that, that's all well and good, but who the hell's going to look at that? The backgrounds became more important than the animation. He'd made them look more like Christmas cards. Sleeping Beauty missed its February 1957 release date, and then its Christmas 1957 release date. It was already the longest running production in the studio's history, and shaping up to be their most expensive. As well as Earl's artistic demands and the overall pedantic attention to detail, another hurdle was the decision to use the Super Technorama 70mm format, the first film of any kind to ever do so. The format was even wider than the CinemaScope format used on Lady and the Tramp, and the 70mm negative captured an alarming amount of detail. "When you have three fairies," said Ollie Johnson, "and you want a close-up of a fairy, it's impossible unless you're going to get it to just the eyes or something. You couldn't get rid of a fairy. I mean, you'd end up with three of them. There was no way around it. And that took a long time because you've got to draw all that stuff so carefully." Many of the artists also blamed Walt's absence for the drawn-out process. While the story had mostly been settled on since 1953, there was still much detail to work out, and the general consensus was that the cold, austere nature of the film could have been prevented with Walt's participation, or at least guidance. "He wouldn't have story meetings," recalled Milt Call. "He wouldn't get the damn thing moving." In March 1958, with Sleeping Beauty having missed two more release dates, Ivan Earle left the project to work for John Sutherland Productions. It isn't clear whether his decision to leave Disney had anything to do with tensions on the film, but it would be almost another year before it would reach the screen. As soon as Earle left, Geronimi had the textures in his background softened and diluted. But Earle had achieved something monumental with his work on Sleeping Beauty. Walt had wanted him to push the film to its visual limits, and Earle had exceeded all expectations. No animated film of this scale had ever been made before, and no animated film of this scale would ever be made again.
Well, to finish up on our conversation, there's one last question that I ask every guest in this podcast, and that is, what is your favourite Disney animated classic?
That's such a big question.
Yes. I always love the reactions I get from people when I ask this. No one that seems to ever know it's coming, and they're just like, oh, no, don't ask me that.
Why did I not think that was coming? I don't know. I could go with Pocahontas. Yeah, I'll go Pocahontas.
Why Pocahontas?
Oh, good music. I love a wild girl running in the forest. It's what I want to do. Yeah, I'll stick with that.
I mean, the music in Pocahontas is insane. Like, it's absolutely nuts, that score. It's so beautiful. Well, Dimity, thank you so much for sharing your time and your experiences and your stories and your perspectives on this film. It's been a real treat. Thank you so much for joining us on Income Paint.
You're very welcome. Thanks for having me.
A new release date for Sleeping Beauty was set for January 1959, and this one had to be adhered to. Walt may have said that time and money didn't matter for his magnum opus, but now it had become so enormous that it was devouring the studio's resources. It needed to come to an end. In a famous photograph from the making of Sleeping Beauty, Walt and Eric Larson are standing in a corridor, looking at the artwork from the film that covers the walls. Many years later, animator Andreas Degas asked Larson what he and Walt had been discussing, whether they had been looking at the artwork and taking in what they had achieved. "No," Larson replied. It wasn't a congratulatory conversation. Walt was telling Larson that Sleeping Beauty was now costing so much money that if it failed at the box office, Walt Disney Productions might never be able to make another feature animated film again. On the next episode of Ink and Paint.
Funny that the representation of pure evil dresses fabulously, has great colour palette, has the most ridiculous voice I've ever heard.
I'm joined by Melbourne-based theatre maker Stephen Nicolazzo for the second part of our look at Sleeping Beauty. Thanks again to Dimity Azzouri for joining me on this episode. You can follow Dimity on Instagram at Dimity Azzouri and learn more about the work of the Australian Ballet at australianballet.com.au. Be sure to check out the show notes on this episode at inkandpaint.com.au for more information about the making of Sleeping Beauty, including concept art and animation sketches. You can follow Ink and Paint on Twitter, Instagram and Facebook at inkpaintpod for bonus material and news on upcoming episodes. You can also email Daniel at inkandpaint.com.au and find me on Twitter at Daniel Lamon. We release new episodes every fortnight, as well as bonus in-betweeners every now and then. So if you enjoyed the show, please rate, review, and subscribe on your favorite podcasting platform. And don't forget to tell your friends. Ink and Paint was created, hosted, and written by myself, Daniel Lamon, and produced and edited by Alex Amster. Theme music is composed by Sam Porter. The show artwork is designed by Nicholas Piranakis, with episode illustrations by Lily Meek, and the podcast is released through Switch. MakeTheSwitch.com.au. Join in next time on Ink and Paint to continue our journey through the Disney animated classics.